风就雨 When what is no And what isn't inspired I will be strong for you And when the day begins to fight Against the fickle
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 15th of October. We are delighted to have you here. We have a great show and wonderful panelists and a lot to talk about, so we will get right to it. We certainly are happy that you are here, and our job is to just make sure that we don't upset you. And that you keep listening.
Now you say it.
Well, I mean, you can be fired up. I mean, you know, to the point where you're ready to take action.
Okay.
We welcome Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and Local Power is the mm-hmm. name of the group. Communities for Local Power.
That's the one.
Yes. And former White House Advance Lead Anna Markowitz is with us. Hello, Anna. How are you?
I'm doing great. Going to try to keep it upbeat and not upset the listeners. Thank you for
yes.
that pep talk. That's what
well,
I needed.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't mean upset. Like, we're not going to sugarcoat anything. I just, you know, I want people to be comfortable listening as they always are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we welcome, and he's great to have him back. Alexander Mihailovich is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and teaching the graduate program at Middlebury College Russian School. He's also the author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, and it's a delight to have you back to our program.
Great to be here at my favorite time of year, which is autumn.
Yes, it is. It's a nice time to be in the Northeast, no question about it. We also welcome Robert Pondicio, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I am well, Joe, but now I feel like I'm on tenterhooks here. Like if the goal today is to not upset the listeners, then I'm in the wrong room.
That's not what I meant. I want people to be engaged, and I want people to get to be happy, to be angry, to all of those things. I just to the point where you don't want them you know, canceling their membership.
Fine line. I call it angry.
Mean?
Can I call that
you
one?
Know, like,
but
that's what I meant, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
First rule of holes applies here. When,
yes.
when you're in one, stop digging.
That's. I wish I had done that 10 minutes ago. Well, we welcome you all. Thank you very much for being here. And let's start with the story that has taken up the headlines for most of this week, and rightfully so. Trump says the U.S. will disarm Hamas if it does not do so itself. President Donald Trump said Tuesday that the United States could step in to disarm Hamas quickly and perhaps violently, quote unquote, if the organization did not do it itself. A potential vulnerability in a U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement that has tentatively brought an end to 2 years of war between Israel and Hamas. This from reporting from the Washington Post by Amy Wang and Sammy Westfall. Hamas, which has controlled Gaza for nearly two decades, has not yet publicly agreed to or signed anything that specifies how it will disarm, though Trump suggested Tuesday that he has received verbal assurances that the group would. Everyone says, oh, well, they won't disarm. They will disarm, Trump said Tuesday at a White House event. And I spoke to Hamas and I said, you're going to disarm, right? Yes, sir, we're going to disarm. That's what they told me. They will disarm or we will disarm them. Got it? Okay. So Trump declined to provide specifics on how the United States would do that. And when asked about a deadline, said that it would be a reasonable period of time. What is a reasonable period of time, Alex?
Well, that's a good question because, in fact, the hostages, the 20 remaining hostages, will be officially released on Monday. So this is a kind of an in-between period, you know, where the agreement, technically speaking, has not taken effect. And one of the consequences of this is that Hamas is essentially freely using the weapons it has to what they see as a form of disciplining of the Gazan population, the people whom they consider to be traitors among the Palestinians in the territory. Many of them are getting arrested or executed. So this is all kind of bluster, it seems to me, because in fact this period of, you know, this kind of pause, you know, in the 20-point security plan taking effect is resulting in the short term in considerable acts of localized violence. Yes, the Israeli Defense Force incursion within the territory has stopped. However, one paradoxical effect of all of this is that Hamas has been put into the position of being the official voice of the Gazan population, not the Palestinian Authority. And so we can talk about the different ways in which the Palestinian Authority over an extended period of time has kind of lost its street cred. It hasn't had much respect among the Palestinians in general and the Palestinian Gazans in particular. However, I'm a little bit concerned about the ways in which Gaza is becoming empowered, almost in an official capacity. Essentially, what is happening is that Israel is recognizing Hamas as the voice of the Palestinians within Gaza. And I'm not sure that's necessarily a good development.
So let me ask before I want to hear from everyone, but when we've been talking just over the last 24, 48 hours about there's the agreement and then there's all this other stuff that needs to be worked out that is really the big keys to the deal. This is part of what we're talking about, right?
It is.
Yeah,
it is. And, you know, the 20-point peace plan is very interesting. I mean, one of the things that it leaves open is the possibility of the establishment of a dual-state solution. But, and in many respects, the 20-point peace plan is what Biden had in place as well. The details are not terribly different. What has changed are the conditions on the ground and globally. Very specifically, the Trump administration and other countries have choked off the support of Iran, of Hamas, but also the Qataris, who are now firmly on Trump's side, you know, even though in many respects Qatar, you know, pursues officially at least, an Islamist, policy. But now they have established a kind of, really a sort of a financial arrangement with Qatar where they're going to, Hegseth has spoken about establishing a Qatari-run military base in Utah, I think, or Oklahoma. I can't remember which. There's talk of this kind of amped up, economic relations between Qatar and the United States, which has motivated Qatar to sort of stop the flow of military support to Hamas. Right. So that's what's changed. And I'm not taking anything away from Trump and his negotiating team. But let me just say that much of what we're seeing in that plan is essentially an extension of what of previous administrations or the previous administration with, objective circumstances globally having changed, which is what affected this, this turnaround.
Robert.
Well, I both love and dislike being on the roundtable with Alex and discussing foreign affairs because he is a genuine expert and I'm just, some guy who reads the papers. So I mostly agree with what you're saying, with one or two mild caveats. One, I mean, I think that the plan, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but to my mind, it's what's the difference between now and a year or so ago? Well, the difference is the Trump administration's use of physical force and as you say, the facts on the ground. No attack on Iran, no attack on Qatar,
right.
No deal. Right. So yeah. I think that's the kinetic reality, as it were, I think, has brought these parties to the table. In terms of, you know, Trump's, you know, typical inarticulate posturing about disarming Hamas, I think the permission structure now exists for him to say things like that and mean it, because they have both Israel and the U.S. have demonstrated time and again that they're less concerned with diplomatic niceties than imposing their will. So, and, you know, vis-a-vis the 20-point plan, well, the most salient point, right, Alex, is the troops have withdrawn and the hostages, the living hostages at least, are home.
Yeah.
So what leverage does Hamas have? And by the way, as soon as I say the word leverage, it's an echo of that, to my mind, kind of irresponsible thing the New York Times did earlier this week, where they referred to those living hostages as Hamas's, quote, leverage, which struck me as inelegant, to put it nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But back to where we are right now, the living hostages are home.
Yeah.
The shooting has ended. Mm. If Trump is saying we will disarm them, I assume that he means it, and it has to be taken seriously.
No, I don't.
We're not disagreeing.
We're not really disagreeing. You're simply, you know, elaborating on these facts, you know, at the grassroots level, which I think are important to bear in mind. Here's the difficulty. It seems to me, by recognizing Hamas as the representative for the region. What
de facto or
well, not de facto, not officially, but de facto, presenting it in that position. One consequence of this is that if they are in fact kind of the administration of the Gaza, you allow, or it's kind of you're opening up the fire door for them to have an internal security force, like essentially.
How is that different? And I'm asking this in earnest. It's not a challenge. I just don't know. How is that different than the last 20 years when Hamas has been functionally the political leadership of Gaza?
It's not different. I guess that's largely the point that I'm trying to make.
They haven't been removed from.
They haven't been removed from power. You know, so you know they you know in you know as a kind of you know as how can I put it. As a political power that has its own army that can act, you know, in this sort of, you know, in a way, in vis-a-vis other countries in the region, you know, that has been, so it seems, detoothed. But what has not been taken away is this kind of regional authority, internal authority for Gaza itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're allowing them essentially, or recognizing them as the primary spokesperson or, you know, entity, you know, for, you know, the population of that area. And there are all sorts of problems that have to be addressed. It's not just a matter of, Hamas as a military organization. Mm-hmm. 80 to 90% of the structures, architectural structures in the area have been destroyed, you know. The single most among Palestinians living in Gaza right now, the single most needed resource is not food, but cleaning supplies, you know. And so, you know, reconstruction has to take place, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very, you know, nervous about the idea of, you know, of Hamas, you know, I don't think it's even equipped to deal with a project like that.
Yeah.
You know? So that's my main concern.
Well, if Israel's war aim was the and I don't know how they phrased it at the time, the elimination, the destruction of Hamas, then what you're suggesting is that goal, even if the fighting is over, even if they are disarmed, as a political matter, that goal has not been met.
Not fully.
Okay.
I would put it this way, you know. So anyway.
Yeah.
Anna.
I mean, I think you make a really interesting point about Hamas there. It is my understanding that they are going to be receiving amnesty if they turn in their guns. And so I'm hoping that means that while they'll be, you know, protected from, you know, execution or things of that level, that hopefully they'll be removed and there'll be some sort of rebuilding and change of leadership there. But I think that there's a lot that could go wrong in this. I think that Netanyahu hasn't verbally said that this is, in fact, the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when Trump went to Egypt and had a meeting with many different leaders to try to hash out the details, there weren't a lot of concrete outcomes that came from that about, like, how is this actually going to happen? Is there going to be a two-state solution? Who's going to lead Gaza and Palestine? Like, so, you know, I think that it's great that the hostages are returned, and this is a great step, but I think that we still need to see if this is going to stick or if this is going to unravel and just go back to war again.
Yeah, and another element of all this, of course, is internal Israeli politics. You know, I have a little bit of a bee in my bonnet when anybody says anti-Israel. Not because I don't think it has anything to do, bears no relation to anti-Semitism, but because it's very imprecise. I mean, Israel is a parliamentary democracy. Like many democracies, it is highly imperfect. However, you can't talk about it as a single bolus. It is not a single entity. It is not a person, all right? The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, has many different parties, you know, all the way from the far, far right to the far, far left, all right? One of the most leftist parties in the Israeli parliament, the Hadash party, is, you know, not only are they very critical vis-a-vis Netanyahu and the Likud party, they're very critical of the entire military campaign in Gaza, which they consider one of their leaders, Ofer Kassab, has called it a genocide, right? And, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, applying that term, and I'm not even going to, you know, I'm not addressing the whole question of how valid that term is. I'm just talking about the kinds of discussions that you're hearing in Israel, so many of which are kind of teasing through these ideas, you know. And there are many people within political power, within many of the parties, who do consider this as being a kind of a human rights outrage, the way it was done, right? Not necessarily that it was done.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We will continue the conversation and move on to other topics as well after this break from the BBC.
I feel like I am an imposter. Can't be bothered to name or remember just what I ever had to offer. If you could have anything.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome to the program Anna Markowitz, Alexander Mihailovich, and Robert Pandisio, and we, of course, welcome you and your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Alex, I was interested when you were talking earlier at the beginning of your remarks, you mentioned sort of the timeline and what we're looking at as far as the next release of more hostages, right? Yeah. And so what do you see the timeline over the next week or two of how that's going to unfold?
Well, I think that, one is hesitant to make sort of concrete predictions, but I think that the hostages will be released because, you know, Hamas doesn't have that many, you know, good cards in its hand right now. I think that's what is more murky is the political solution to, you know, all of this. One other wild card is, you know, the whole question of human rights violations in Gaza. I don't care for the term genocide that people have used in regard, you know, to the last 2 years in Gaza. I think that it doesn't fit the situation. However, I think that there is definitely an element, at the very least, of ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is not, you know, it's not physical extermination. It's simply the removal, physical removal, or expulsion, or harassment of local populations. And the precedent here that's very clear is the war of the 90s in the Balkans, what was occurring in parts of Serbia, well, more specifically Bosnia and some limited areas in Croatia. And the whole question is now the Gazans who are returning, first of all, how many of them will return? That's one question. It seems that only a fraction, because people have settled elsewhere, essentially. And the other thing is, which I alluded to, the factor is that's very important, is the paucity of physical resources in Gaza right now. You know, cleaning supplies, food. You know, already, you know, the corridor for food and other forms of aid in Rafah, the border with Egypt, has been is still essentially closed. So it's not clear if there's going to be enough of that available for the returning population, and more people will return, obviously, only if there's a prospect for that coming about, because they're not going to go back to a situation where they're, you know, essentially don't have enough to live on.
Well, again, Alex, you're the expert. But I can't shake the feeling that things are just as different and unexpected in the Middle East as they've been in my lifetime. And we're, you know, roughly the same age. We're both in our 60s. And I attribute that to this administration, whether you like Donald Trump or not, its willingness to both use and authorize force. In other words, you know, the niceties of diplomacy have been set aside, and the obvious posture is force and the willingness to use it. So I'm not blithe about the humanitarian aspects of this, but it just feels to me like you almost have to throw out the playbook at this point. Things are just different.
Right. I agree in part with what you're saying. Just a qualifier here. It seems to me that there is an element of diplomacy, but it's not traditional diplomacy.
There you go. Well said.
You know, I mean, in regard to Qatar, you know, because I find that very interesting, because you know, this was, you know, a form of kind of, you know, mutual ego massaging, you know? And but also, you know, financial incentive. And I mean, look, you know, another element.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. Isn't that where things changed with that strike on Qatar? And sure, you know, reportedly Trump called Bibi on the carpet over it.
Right.
But once Israel said, look, if you're in Hamas, or if you're sheltering Hamas, you are not safe. You can no longer rely on this distant remove from the battlefield.
Right.
We're going to find you. We're going to get you.
Right.
To me, that was the moment where everything changed.
That is the moment where everything changed. It was, you know, Netanyahu's, you know, shift, you know, in terms of, like, you know, actual, I mean, you know, engaging in a military, you know, conflict with a neighboring country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's quite clear. I just want to point out, however, that the level of material, you know, military support from the United States, from the Biden administration to the Trump administration, hasn't changed that dramatically. What has changed is this willingness to widen the conflict, in a sort of a measured, careful way, you know, in the manner of two porcupines making love. You know, so,
paints a picture.
I think that, you know, I think it's important to recognize the kind of continuity of American policy across,
sure.
You know, but, you know, what has changed is, you know, the sort of the non-traditional means that Trump has used, which is not necessarily directly, physical incursion, you know, enforcement, but rather, one-on-one, interactions with, you know, leaderships of other countries.
But I guess my question is how that changing of the pieces on the chessboard and the willingness of the U.S. to both use force or authorize its ally Israel to use force, how does that change the calculus going forward when you look at the rest of the 20-point plan? In other words, it's things are, if we agree that things are different, well, how does that things are different mindset change things moving forward?
Well,
and I'm asking in earnest because I just don't know the answer.
Yeah, to be perfectly honest, I don't know either.
Okay.
You know, I think that there are many imponderables here. You know, Anna, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you mentioned that Hamas was alienated a lot more than it had been in the past, and that was a big change. I think Israel has also. I think that after the Qatar attack, and due to the, you know, increasing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, Europe has pulled away from them. They've lost all of their allies, except for Donald Trump. And so I think the reliance on him to stay an ally really forced Netanyahu to kind of swallow, bite his tongue more than he would have before. Mm-hmm. And so I think that even though he doesn't want this 20-point plan, neither does Hamas, I think they both feel like there's no other choice because they're both in such a hard place that they have to at least, you know, say that they're going to do it. We'll see if they actually can follow through. I think that that's...
No, I think that's an excellent way of putting it, Anna. I mean, I think that one thing about the 20-point plan that strikes me is how notional so much of it is. You know, I mean, they're only the parts of it that are more concrete and, sort of have a kind of a force of compulsion has to do with the disarmament, of Hamas.
Yeah.
But the large swaths of the rest of it, especially in regard to this, you know, the possibility of a two-state solution, it's just piffle. You know, it's putting it on the record that we recognize that this is the aspiration of many people within Gaza, and you know we're not hostile against it. Okay. But you know, I don't see that as
since the creation of Israel,
right? Yeah, and that's been the aspiration of many people within Israel, and with Gaza itself, So, I think that's just kind of a form of throat clearing, So, anyway,
we have a couple. We have many letters actually. So let's go to a break right now, and when we come back, we'll stick with the letters, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this.
The only war we have a chance of winning will be the one defended by Thanksgiving. I could be the if and you could be the and.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, listening to the music of Rachel Sage and the Sequins playing at The Colony on October 19th. I'm still not used to the 10 being October yet. You know what I mean? Like when I see 10, I'm like, oh, God, it's October. Is it really October?
We're halfway through. Might as well just go right on to the
11th. My goodness, yeah. Well, there you go. Rachel Sage and the Sequins at The Colony on the 19th of this month. And you can find out more and see all of the tracks we played by going to our playlist, which is at wamc.org/roundtable. As promised, we have a lot of letters, and we'll get to as many of those as we possibly can. We begin with Jerome, who says, I want to ask what the panel thinks the difference is between Israel and Ukraine. That is to say, why do they think Trump is willing to give arms to Israel and not Ukraine to aid in the war efforts?
This is possibly shifting, the situation, because Trump has indicated that he's willing to sell Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. So we'll see. I think that paradoxically, to answer that question, the situation in Israel and Gaza were coming to a head, in a certain sense diplomatically, in terms of this untraditional diplomacy, and this was an easier short-term win for Trump. This is like a feather in his cap, motivated in part by his desire to receive the Nobel Peace Prize.
Imagine saying that Mideast peace is the easier thing to do.
I know. I was aware of the weirdness of that statement when I made it. But there are, all sorts of other circumstances about Ukraine that are more difficult and intractable, and so And, you know, ultimately he wanted, you know, he wanted a feather in his cap, you know, and this was the one that was more at hand. And yeah.
And to be fair, it's not a bad feather.
No, it's not.
And, you know, speaking to kind of the chessboard of, you know, who's allies with who, I think that Netanyahu is in a worse spot than Putin is in, because Putin still has China.
Yeah.
And so he was, you know, when Trump tried to bring them all together in Alaska and say, hey, we're going to negotiate peace, Putin was just like, no.
Yeah.
I think he felt like he had more options.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Absolutely.
Back to the letters we go, and Vincent checks in and says the current ceasefire is highly imperfect and uncertain. However, the bottom line was that the previous scenario was completely unsustainable for all parties involved. Perhaps it should be assumed that there will be setbacks and stumbles, and to put mechanisms in place designed with patience and a bias towards continual improvement versus perfection.
Why didn't I say that?
Nicely put.
Yeah, I mean, are we too knee-jerky? Are we not patient enough?
No, I think we're cautious. You know, skeptical in a healthy way.
Yeah.
You know?
But the writer's point about assume that there will be I don't remember the exact word he used, pitfalls or missteps is
setbacks and stumbles.
Yeah.
Good
and
wise.
I mean, I think one thing we didn't have time to talk about is the whole situation in the West Bank. And how that may, you know, affect, you know, discussions in Gaza.
Let's spend a moment on that, because we spoke about that at some length yesterday on the program, and even the day before, actually. And I'm curious as to your take on that, because there did seem to be a range of opinion from the panel on that.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, if Israel proceeds with, you know, the expansion of the settlements in the West Bank, that could harden the stance of Hamas and reignite, for example, a pipeline of support from Iran, you know. So that's, I mean, this is one possibility, one scenario. I'm not saying it will happen. It does seem that the administration is largely supportive of Israeli policy in the West Bank, you know, on the basis of statements of the American ambassador. So, yeah, we'll see.
I'm interested, and I don't know the answer to this, Alex. Maybe you do. What has Iran's posture been towards this deal? I vaguely recall hearing that they made some warm statement about it.
They've been largely, you know, made a series of anodyne,
okay,
you know, statements
that
about it.
That says something, right?
That does say something. However, this might change if Israel decides to, you know, harden its stance, you know, about real estate in the West Bank.
Yeah, but this gets back to my point about the use of force to force diplomacy. Iran surely has been chastened in the last year.
It has been chastened. There's no question. It has been chastened.
And that must change the calculus.
I think it does. I think that there are other. Iran is also motivated by other, you know, factors. You know, its relation to China and the Russian Federation, and you know, the instability of support from those two countries. You know, I mean, in terms of economic relations. Mm-hmm. You know. Because Iran is trying to find its foothold in the world, in the so-called multipolar world, and it's, you know, it's made all these. It's very interested in the idea of entering into the sort of the economic consortium, of the kind of notional economic consortium of the Russian Federation and China and other countries, and possibly North Korea. So. Yeah, so I think that it's proceeding very cautiously.
Lily writes to us and says, I was appalled to hear your panelists depict this fragile period and the ceasefire as an interim time before the deal has taken effect. The deal is in effect. The living Israeli hostages have all been returned. Due to the leveling of Gaza, it is challenging to locate the bodies of many of the remaining hostages, and this was known to both sides at the time of the signing of the deal. While the discussion of disarming Hamas is the focus of many Western media outlets, Israel has violated the ceasefire agreement multiple times already, using drones and even airstrikes to kill further civilians. That from Lily.
Is that correct?
Well, it's correct in terms of, you know, flare-ups at the borders.
Yeah,
you know,
the drones but I
haven't heard about the drones and airstrikes. Yeah. I've heard of the Israeli Defense Force, you know, interacting, having recently, just a couple of days ago, sort of violent confrontations, you know,
with people at the border. They shot six Palestinians, but also Hamas is in violation right now by not returning the bodies on the timeline they promised. Now, to the listener's point, some of them may be having trouble locating some of them.
Right.
But surely that was something they knew in negotiating the deal.
Yeah, they did. They did. And, you know, and there's the additional factor of, you know, the location of those bodies, you know, of people who might have died, you know, either been executed or, you know, more likely in many cases, you know, having been killed, you know, because of, you know, being Israeli, you know, campaign, military, you know, strategy. I think that, yeah, that's going to be a very, I mean, given the, you know, the ruins of the territory, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult, you know, to find those bodies. I think many people on both sides simply don't know where they are at this point.
We got this from Stu, who writes, can the panel address what I see as the elephant in the room? That peace with a just resolution to the larger conflict is the last thing the Israeli government and society wants. The return of taken land is not conceivable. An endless conflict provides the breathing room for Israel to continue to expand.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think that that's the crux of how is this actually going to play out in real life, that we don't know how amenable Netanyahu is going to be to a two-state solution and what that state is going to look like, and how, you know, I think that there's a lot that could go wrong, because I mean, I think that we have the wrong leader in Israel right now. I wish it was almost any other human than Netanyahu. I think that he so far has looked for every opportunity to exploit the situation, and hopefully he has realized that his political capital has been demolished and that he really needs to be a good actor now and follow through with it. But I don't know.
But back to my point about a chastened Iran and Qatar coming to the table and accepting their responsibility, it feels to me, and again, I'm going to defer to Alex on this, it feels to me like the question of Israel's legitimacy is no longer on the table to the degree that it once was. In other words, my sense is a major takeaway of this is going to be an awareness, not an awareness, but an acceptance on behalf of much of the Middle East and the Islamic world that, no, Israel's not going away.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I would like to think is that this is kind of a reenacting, sort of a reawakening of the within, you know, Arab-speaking countries in the area of Hosni Mubarak's, you know, dream of some kind of you know, workable, you know, recognition of Israel, you know, which, you know, ended up, you know, going south very, you know, tragically. You know, perhaps this is going to be a return to that. I mean, there's already indications, and here I do have to give some credit to, you know, the Trump administration for working closely, not just with Qatar, but also with the United Arab Emirates and with Saudi Arabia in, you know, in moving closer to some kind of, you know, coalition of oil-producing countries in the area that, you know, recognize Israel's territorial integrity.
Do you foresee more countries signing on to the Abraham Accords?
Not anytime soon.
Okay.
You know, this is my sense. I think things are going to probably move forward like a step and a half forward, half step back. So it's going to be...
That's still forward.
Yeah, it's still forward, but, you know.
We go to Carol, who, I apologize, we go to Denise, who writes, so just how will Trump violently disarm Hamas? Send in our troops, send in Qatari troops, let loose Israeli troops. Sounds like a bunch of BS unless he commits American troops. And are we ready for that?
I can't imagine this administration's posture on foreign involvement allowing for putting American troops on the ground.
Yeah, he's going to, you know, what's going to happen, he'll say, you know, let the Israeli Defense Force, engage in its defensive function.
Then we go to this letter from Russ. Trump's dismissive reply to the reporter asking about the disarmament of Hamas screens a real problem. If Hamas will not disarm, and it clearly has no intention of doing so, how many American divisions would be required to hold the population of Gaza at bay while a search for Hamas members is conducted? As Israel knows, there is no practical way to sort out the militants. That is why Israel has halted the attack on Gaza City, as the result would be a terrible blot on Israeli history. Anyone on that?
I think that, you know, the Gazans have more immediate problems that they have to deal with. Healthcare, you know, rebuilding, resettlement, the ones who have decided to come back. Hamas has been, you know, humiliated, you know, it seems to me. So I think that this is going to be a kind of, you know, well, you know, it's going to be a period of restructuring, of recouping, of, you know, one's strength. I don't think that Hamas is going to have its former profile again.
Yeah, I agree.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to new topics. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this break.
Every time you give me a squeeze, I feel alone.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Wednesday morning, the 15th of October. It is 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Joining us on the panel, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead Anna Markowitz. Alexander Mihailovich is here. He is Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and is teaching in the graduate program at Middlebury College Russian School. Also, Robert Pendicio is with us, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We welcome you to join in on the conversation, panel at WAMC.org. Keep your letters short, to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. Panel at WAMC.org. From the New York Times, the headline, which is Trump says he may give tomahawks to Ukraine. Is he bluffing? Fresh off negotiating a peace deal intended to end the war in Gaza, President Trump on Tuesday suggested that he may allow a sale of U.S.-made Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, giving Kyiv the ability to conduct long-range strikes deep into Russia. That is exactly the kind of message that President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine wants to hear as he prepares for a visit to the White House on Friday. Who'd like to have tomahawks, Mr. Trump said of Mr. Zelensky, and we have a lot of tomahawks. But it's also something that President Vladimir Putin of Russia has warned against, saying that such a sale would signal a new stage of escalation. So, Alexander, we talked about this a bit in a listener question asking about the difference between the difference and similarities between the situation in Gaza and what is happening in Ukraine. But to this particular point of the tomahawks, what should we make of it?
Well, I think this is in part Trump, I would say, competing with Europe in terms of support of Ukraine. the several EU countries have already promised Tomahawk missiles, or I put it this way, they've bought Tomahawk missiles mm-hmm. from the U.S. to give to Ukraine. So for now, $2 billion have been set aside, you know, from Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Netherlands, Germany, and Canada to provide these missiles to Ukraine. Now, I think a really important aspect of this is to ask what are these missiles for? Why does Ukraine want them? Given the fact that Ukraine's drone capabilities, combative drone capabilities, have become the best in the world now, which allows them to enter, you know, to sort of engage in some sort of small-scale forays within Russian territory, with the territory of the Russian Federation. They want these missiles, which have a much bigger punch, and are more precise than the drones in many ways. They have greater explosive capabilities, obviously. They want them to strike at oil refineries within the Russian Federation because Zelensky correctly understands now, just on the basis of experience of this war, that this is the chink in the armor of the Russian Federation's military capabilities. It is also something that directly affects the Russian economy because oil is the single largest energy resource that Russia provides to the world, the second being gas, natural gas, and that if you hit those oil refineries, the Russian economy goes into a tailspin. And this then is felt by the pocketbooks of people, of Russian civilians, right? So one of the reasons why, you know, I think the main reason why the Russian Federation specifically, you know, in terms of the statements of Sergei Lavrov and Vladimir Putin about why they consider this to be a turning point, because it affects the global economic profile of the Russian Federation. And also, you know, with the destruction of these oil refineries by Tomahawk missiles, they would have less oil to sell to India and to China, you know, which is, you know, the primary means by which Russia cements its diplomatic relations with those two countries.
Yeah, and I think that in terms of strategy, like, I think everything that you said is right. And I think that Trump likes to scare people into negotiating with him. And I think that he's essentially saying, hey, Putin, like, you better come back to the negotiating table and be a little bit more flexible next time, or I could sell these missiles to the Ukraine and then that would destroy your economy. You make the choice. So I think that he's kind of using fear as a negotiating tactic again.
In this instance, it's not merely the threat. We now have a real-world example, as we were discussing in the previous segment, of using force to force the hand of your adversaries to negotiate. My novice view of this is that, you know, the previous episode we described, the Israel-Hamas negotiation showed that credible use of force can shift the balance of facts on the ground, as you put it, Alex. So now the question in my mind is, does a similar deterrence, which again I think is real, not merely bluster, does that logic apply to a great power? I mean, Russia is not Hamas.
Right. Russia is not Hamas, but it has different interests or different categories of sort of political capital that it considers to be important for itself.
Yeah.
And I think it's really economics. And in my opinion, and I've gotten into some arguments with friends of mine and other people in the field of Russian and Eurasian studies about this. One of the main reasons why Russia was so interested in Ukraine, wanted to invade Ukraine after recognizing, you know, for over two decades its territorial sovereignty, is that it wanted to diversify its economy by having freer access to the resources of Ukraine, specifically the rare earth
minerals.
But also shale. Ukraine has the largest of all countries in the globe as the largest untapped shale deposits. Hmm. All right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so there's actually here also, you know, an aspect we need to consider, which is why is the United States so interested in Ukraine? It's not entirely idealistic. I mean, there are companies in the U.S. that specialize in oil and, in coal that would be very interested, you know, in having access to those deposits as well.
But wait, how is, when you say shale, I assume you mean fracking. Oil.
Fracking, yes.
How does that diversify Russia's economy?
So it kind of, you know, that's a good way of, it's an excellent question. I think, you know, right now, in terms of energy resources, it's oil and gas. Mm-hmm. All right. So this is a category or a subcategory of oil, but it would essentially, expand the profile of Russia as a global economic power.
I see.
And the other thing to bear in mind is why Russia was so interested in Ukraine is that its agricultural resources.
Sure.
You know, and this is huge because it is, it is, I believe, the third largest, exporter of wheat in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it. And then the Russian Federation is four. United States and, interestingly, France are at the top. All right. There is many people within the right and within the right of the Russian Federation who are very, very conservative and nationalistic and patriotic. A vast majority of them will grudgingly acknowledge that Russia needs to diversify its economy.
Yeah.
It's nothing but a gas station to the world,
yeah,
run by a mafia. That's John McCain.
A gas station with nuclear weapons.
Right, John McCain. But you know, many Russians who are otherwise very pro-Putin, they say this is absolutely true.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So how is Putin going to respond to this? Is what's your best guess to the provocation of, or I shouldn't call it a provocation, the potential threat of sending more Tomahawks?
We'll see what's going to happen. I'm not sure how it's going to play out.
Okay. If you're not sure, then
no, I'm not absolutely sure. I think that one thing that's going to happen is that Russia is going to amp up its military campaigns in Kherson and Zaporizhia,
okay, and
particularly the nuclear power plant, which, by the way, in Zaporizhia in Ukraine, is actually on the grid with the Russian Federation.
Huh.
The Russian Federation operates that one. So they are trying to get, they're trying to use that as a kind of a foothold for like a strategic bargaining chip with Ukraine, which is why it's so interested in that particular territory. This is what I suspect is that, anyway.
And I think it's harder for Trump to push Putin as hard as he's pushing in the Middle East because there are nuclear weapons. And,
yeah,
you know, Putin has that in his back pocket. And hopefully we never see him pull that out, but it's there.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of those categories of nuclear weapons that he has in his back pocket are the so-called tactical nuclear
mm-hmm.
weapons, which are not as destructive in some ways. And that's what he's been threatening to use very specifically, in such a case. We'll see what happens. I mean, I think that economics is a big driver in the Russian Federation. And if they feel that their economic status is being threatened or at risk, they may modify their belligerent politics,
mm-hmm.
But if you look at, I'm sorry to keep going back to this example, but if you look at the Hamas-Israel deal as a model, so to speak, which,
mm-hmm.
I think we both agree is functionally Hamas surrendering, there's no prospect for that here. There's no one side is being humiliated.
Yeah.
The other side has every incentive to come to the table.
You
don't see that.
I don't see that in the immediate future,
either.
However, I will say that we need to acknowledge here not so much Trump's role in sort of, forcing the conflict or like bringing it to a point of possible negotiation, but the European Union's
mm-hmm.
and Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine has been, they have fought this war with great ingenuity and resourcefulness
mm-hmm.
and more power to them.
Yeah.
You can only respect, what they've done. And they're fighting for their survival,
That's right.
you know. And what I find troubling about Trump's way of talking about this, he describes it as a war, and it's always in this kind of passive voice. No, it's not a war. It's an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has always been an invasion. And whatever, involvement, of Ukraine in Russian territory of the Russian Federation, it's always been these non-civilian targets and always, almost always, targeting energy resources.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask this question, which is some of it we've talked about, but given that it wasn't all that long ago, there was that disastrous meeting between Zelensky and Trump in the Oval Office, since that time, the two have been on good terms, bringing Friday's meeting, bringing Zelensky back to the White House once again. What do you think the agenda is for that meeting ultimately, because of there is the Tomahawks, but there are obviously other important issues that need to be discussed?
I think it's going to be primarily the Tomahawks. I mean, I think, a Trump is competing with the European Union. He considers the European Union to be a military power that is a rival of the United States. That is the one thing, that's going to be really at the center of that talk, I suspect. I don't know, in terms of the meeting last February with J.D. Vance and Trump in the Oval Office with Zelensky, I'm not sure how much of a disaster that was. I think that it was a show. It was a spectacle. It was going to happen no matter what Zelensky did. Zelensky was advocating for his population.
He's wearing suits now.
Yeah, he's wearing suits now.
Jackets. He's learned how to praise Trump effectively.
Yeah. I don't attach great importance to that. So we'll see what happens here.
Let's go to does anybody else on that before we go? Okay. Go to some letters here. Now that Trump has started to figure out that Putin and Russia started the war and that Putin has no respect for him, I wonder what all those Republicans who follow Trump's lead in destroying our support for Ukraine are thinking at this point. Is that a fair question, Robert?
I'm nonplussed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think Trump doesn't think that far in advance in his tactics. I think that he at first was like, I'm going to embarrass Ukraine and I'm going to be on the side of Putin and I'm going to make Ukraine take a bad deal, and then realized that that wasn't going to work. And then now is like, well, now I'm going to scare Putin into, thinking that we could side with Ukraine. And I don't think he's thinking, five steps in advance. I think he's like, okay, that didn't work. What's next? And so, He certainly isn't taking his base into consideration with a lot of the things that he does. Healthcare costs are going to skyrocket. He doesn't really seem to care about that. So I don't know.
Christine writes to us and says, regarding your statement at the beginning of the program on not making listeners mad, I would be mad if these conversations didn't devolve into rehashing, rewording common partisan talking points on issues of the day. I'm not interested in being persuaded. I'm interested in being informed. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org.
Can I just say a word in favor of this conversation today? I've been remarkably refreshed by how non-ideological it has been today. Am I missing something? Or do I just not have the right lens?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question other than to say, in the mail, I am seeing many lenses.
Okay.
That's the best way I know how to describe it. Let's move on to another topic on the table here before we go over to a break. And we talk about the Pentagon press policy. If we don't get to all of this before the break, we can certainly do more afterwards. So we talked about this yesterday, and we know a little bit more now than we did then. Fox News, along with ABC, CBS, and NBC, did not sign the Defense Department's press policy by Tuesday's deadline, having earlier in the day denounced the new regulations in a joint statement that included CNN, which previously said it would not sign. This from reporting by the Washington Post. Today, we join virtually every other news organization in declining to agree to the Pentagon's new requirements, which would restrict journalists' ability to keep the nation and the world informed of important national security issues. That according to the news networks. The policy is without precedent and threatens core journalistic protections. We will continue to cover the U.S. military as each of our organizations has done for many decades, upholding the principles of a free and independent press. Fox's dissent is notable, considering the Trump-friendly views of many of its opinion hosts, whose ranks previously included the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The policy prohibits journalists from accessing or soliciting information that the Defense Department doesn't make available for them and revokes Pentagon press credentials from those who will not sign on. The rules have drawn an anguished chorus of detractors across the ideological spectrum since they were announced last month. Robert, you're a recovering journalist.
Yeah, and this challenges my recovery. I'm not sure it was anguished as much as it was dismissive or derisive. I think anguished is, if I can play editor, it's the wrong word.
Not an anguish chorus?
Yeah, anguish implies despair, right? There's no despair here. This is just, you know,
they won't do the jobs.
Dismissal. Yeah, look, I spent 20 years, as you alluded to, Joe, in the news business before I was in education. I worked at a couple of national magazines. So I share this derisive opposition to the press pledge. But look, this is not Orwell. It's bad PR at the end of the day. And we were discussing off mic earlier. What this will probably do is, frankly, encourage reporters to do the job they should have been doing anyway. Mm. Developing sources, going through public records. In other words, this will probably boomerang. Oh, you're not going to give me official information? Well, by the way, did we ever get a major scoop? Or was any Pulitzer ever won in a press briefing? No. So this is not going to have the effect that they think it's going to have. It's bad PR. It's bad optics for the administration. Mm. And sure, if I'm still a reporter, I'm like, okay, fine. You're going to take away my press credentials? Great. I'll see the generals after work at the bar.
Do you see the administration or Hegseth caving on this?
I don't know how. I mean, it would be I'm not sure how you walk this back. I think you probably just hope for the next news cycle and just hope that people forget about it and then slowly, start reissuing press credentials.
I mean, I think that I'm struck as a Russia specialist how similar this is to the way in which the Soviet Department of the Department of Defense and the Soviet Union dispersed information. what this will mean is that the Pentagon is simply making an announcement, and then it's, up to the press. The press doesn't even need to be physically present there for that. I mean, exactly. this whole presence is kind of superfluous. It's like, what's the point? You can't ask questions. You can't. I mean, you can, but then there's not going to be any response, So, in the Soviet Union, what you had was, you would have these release of, these statements, say about Soviet during the 1980s strategies in Afghanistan, and then the two major newspapers, Pravda and Izvestia, would essentially repeat that and, add some filler here and there, which didn't really mean a great deal, just to sort of make it into a length of an article and not simply a reprint of, Defense Department, speech making.
Yeah.
Those speeches were often printed verbatim anyway, so what are you going to write about?
Yeah.
You'll just add maybe some, speculation about what this means about Soviet policy, in line with Soviet goals and aspirations. All of this changed, of course, in 1985, 86, 87 with Perestroika and Glasnost. Then you had a much more, free discussion, and it was much franker, well, we're going to take this official statement and take it apart, read it in the way of, looking for hints of, you know, sort of shifts in emphasis. You know, there was some of that was going on earlier, but it was much more openly acknowledged. I just find it very strange that that this is even. The Pentagon is even suggesting this.
You know, one thought occurs to me as you're saying that, Alex, and this is not a defense, let me be clear, of what the Pentagon is doing. The real target of this might be the brass. In other words, if you're concerned about how the Pentagon is being portrayed in the media, this is a warning shot across the bow internally to say, if we catch you talking to reporters, you're in trouble.
Well, if they wanted to do that, they could have just brought them all to what?
We'll
take a break and we will continue. We'll get to hear what Anna has to say on this topic and move on to others. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll take a break and get a news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It is the 15th of October, and we thank you so much for being with us. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to get in on the conversation. We're talking right now about media, including Fox News and others. Fox News, along with ABC, CBS, and NBC, not signing the Defense Department's press policy by the deadline yesterday, having earlier in the day denounced the new regulations in a joint statement. Anna.
Yeah. I mean, I think anytime we're comparing our policies on press to Russia, we're moving in the wrong direction. And I think it's a sad day to see all these people who have had desks in the Pentagon for decades clearing out their desks and planning to just remotely cover this department. I mean, this is a huge shift. And I think that we have to look at the larger picture here. It's not just this. It's also trying to cancel Jimmy Kimmel by using, you know, license agreements as leverage. It's trying to say who's going to be in the White House press corps based on how favorably they cover the president. I think that we have to look holistically at this, and this is just one more attempt to restrict the press's access. And I think it's disconcerting, and I'm glad that Fox has taken a stand on the right side of this. This is lovely. And hopefully we fight to bring back the press pool and continue to fight for free press.
I mean, one of the things we talked about yesterday is also that this starts to grow in other departments and in other settings.
Yeah.
Like, but let's not be entirely naive about this, right? In other words, what's new here is how this is being done in plain sight. In other words, there's no nuance or subtlety here where, you know, in the past you might lose your access if you wrote, you know, something unfavorable to the administration. Now they're kind of sticking a flag in the ground and making what used to be kind of a done with a wink and a nod, now doing it, you know, in broad daylight.
Yeah, I do wonder, you know, if Daily Caller, Newsmax, and the Washington Examiner have signed on, you know, to refuse this, policy. If some of that has to do with, you know, the commonsensical, you know, consideration that there may be future, say, Democratic, you know, administrations that decide to, you know, follow this policy, you know, which will then become a precedent.
Yeah.
It's not in their interest, self-interest, you know, or in the interest of, you know, a healthy, you know, marketplace, so-called, of ideas, you know, to have this, you know, become, you know, a fixture in the relations between, you know, the press corps and the government.
Yeah. But I want to be careful that I don't want to sound like I'm defending this. But if you are depending upon official sanction for your access to newsmakers, then you have a bigger problem than your press badge.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, isn't there also, you know, an element of this that we're, you know, Hegseth has discussed, you know, prosecuting, you know, leakers, you know, within the, within the Defense Department and the Pentagon.
Well, hold on, the Obama administration did that.
The but Hegseth has also reinforced this policy, you know, more recently, and kind of wanted to give it a little bit more meat.
Lie,
you know,
detectors and so forth for members of the media.
You know, my best guess here, Joe, is that the Trump administration understands that it is viewed, that its base views the media with skepticism, to put it mildly. So they probably, there's probably a certain amount of political calculus here as well. Like, hey, look at us. We're taking on, you know, the press who we have described as the enemy of the people. Again, it's silly and ham-handed. I don't think it's, anybody's going to lose a Pulitzer over this.
All right, let's talk about the New York Times story in the paper this morning about Trump targeting Democratic districts by halting billions during the shutdown. 2 weeks into the government shutdown, the Trump administration has frozen or canceled nearly $28 billion that had been reserved for more than 200 projects, primarily located in Democratic-led cities. That, according to an analysis by The New York Times, that is, democratically led cities, congressional districts, and states, according to The Times. Each of these infrastructure projects had received federal aid, sometimes after officials spent years pleading in Washington, only to see that money halted as President Trump has looked to punish Democrats over the course of the fiscal stalemate. The Times conducted its analysis by examining federal funding records, which include details about the city and state where each grant recipient is based. The projects include new investments in clean energy, upgrades to the electric grid, and fixes to the nation's transportation infrastructure, primarily in the Democratic strongholds such as New York and California. I would say if you go to the New York Times and you check out, the map is cool to look at and play with see how that
and alarming how much is on New York.
Yes, yes. In some cases, the recipients had started to receive portions of the federal aid only to become casualties in a funding battle that has no end in sight. Anna.
Yeah, I mean, I this is not going to be a popular statement, but I think that this is one of the main reasons why Schumer didn't want to shut down the government the first time, is that he knew that there would be a lot of blowback and it would give a lot of power to the president. And I think, you know, the times are different, and I think that this was the only leverage we had, and I'm not saying it was the wrong choice. I think it was a hard choice. I don't think there was an easy choice. But here we are, and we're seeing the president follow through on a lot of these threats. And, I mean, it's really affecting New York. $18 billion of grants were paused, maybe permanently, for New York City, for the Second Avenue subway line and for the Hudson River Tunnel. That's huge. And also in California. And I mean, it's a lot of money that's going to be canceled. But beyond that, he's going to have the tools to go after agencies like he did USAID. And what is he going to do to the Department of Education that he said he wants to completely eliminate? The EPA, you know, he's really learning from his prior successful attempts to dismantle the government, and we're going to see how much he can get done while it's shut down. So it's a scary time.
I was paying our panel a compliment today a few moments ago and saying that we were being refreshingly non-ideological today.
Sorry.
That's not a criticism. I'm going to try to continue in that vein. And say what worries me about this episode is the growing tendency across our political life to use government power as a weapon. So it's not just this episode, and it's not just enough to win elections anymore. Now both sides want to wield the machinery of government to punish their opponents. So you see this in executive orders. You see this in the weaponization of prosecutions and politically motivated investigations and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I say this all the time. Imagine this power in the hands of your worst enemy. And you don't have to imagine it, because it will be, you know, predictably in the next couple of years. So this is just another example of weaponizing the power of government to punish one's political opponents. Both sides do it. I don't know how we break this cycle. Yeah. It seems like it's now endemic to our politics, and it's unhealthy.
What strikes me is a little bit different here, however, is the fact that it's not simply political opponents. It's large demographics and populations. All right.
Well, in this case, the base.
In this case. Okay, Caroline Leavitt the other day said the quiet part out loud. We would like to restrict funding to Portland because of the protests. I'm sorry. You know, you're talking about large population centers. You're talking about citizens. You're talking about voters. I suppose they're deeply cynical and they think, well, we don't need these voters. They're not going to vote for us anyway. And it's an estate that will, you know, go through the Electoral College to the Democrats. Okay. But let me just remind people of the human cost of this. All right. In Chicago, I'm originally from Chicago. I was born on the north side, and then as a very young kid, we moved to the south side. The south side is overwhelmingly of Chicago African American. The project that the Trump administration, through Russell Vogt, have decided not to fund is to increase commuter lines to the south side of Chicago. This is a very important project. Not having those better commuter lines, they were not good when I was growing up there. All right. In a certain sense, the commuter system, the system of city transportation was a little bit like New York. It was all kind of different companies initially that then became incorporated into this general net. But certain parts of the city were not serviced at all or very, very little, and there were still traces of that unequal treatment. I'm thinking in terms of the subway system in New York. It was. Mm-hmm. The subway system in Chicago the train system in Chicago developed in a very similar way. If you don't, it really affects people and kind of almost pocketbook bread and butter issues if they're not able to easily get to work. And you're also targeting a specific demographic, cultural, racial demographic, right? Chicago is 29% African American, right? It is 28% Hispanic, all right? So it is a majority person of color city. Mm-hmm. And I find this very troubling. I mean, this is partly, my, personal perspective, I suppose, biographical perspective, but that it's not simply your political opponents. Who is to say that these people who live in the city are your opponents? Well, how do you, I'm sorry, okay. This is something that really I find deeply troubling. Caroline Leavitt, who is she to talk about penalizing the entire city of Portland, all right, which includes some people who are not Democrats, all right? Mm-hmm. How this is not simply a matter of divisive politics. It's just pure vengeance.
But, Alex, doesn't this bring us back to the question of why are we having this shutdown to begin with? That's political.
Well, that's political.
And therefore, shouldn't all of this have been foreseeable?
Sure, in principle, but here I must disagree a little bit because I think that the principle why the Democrats didn't want to cave is an important issue. It had to do with the Affordable Health Care Act. Again, this is something that affects people, a large swath of people. It'd be one thing if the Republicans had some concrete ideas of what to put in its place, but they don't. I mean, Mike Johnson has been maddeningly vague about this, not to mention the Trump administration itself.
I would love, Anna, to resolve this dispute, because a few moments ago you implied that Schumer was kind of forced into this this shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the feeling in the nation is, hey, this is our only leverage. Mm-hmm. We have to do something. We can't just fund whatever the Trump administration wants. Let's stand up. This is the hill that we're going to die on. And I think they picked healthcare because it is a popular, concrete thing that every American can say, I understand that my healthcare premiums are going to go up. I understand that, I'm not going to have access to life-saving treatments. It's a very concrete thing to bank this on. And I think that was very strategic because there is going to be blowback. There is going to be the Democrats could see blame. The Trump administration is trying to blame the Democrats for this. Who knows which messaging will stick. But I think that this is hugely political, and it's to say, yeah, we don't want to keep this administration's policies moving forward without standing up.
30-second warning. I
want to hear Anna for 25 of those seconds. It's the day before the shutdown. You were in politics. I wasn't. Schumer comes to you and says, Anna, should I shut down the government? Yes or no?
Oof. I mean, I would have said yeah. And I think that they did the only thing that they could have done. I don't know if it will blow back in their face. We'll see in the midterm elections.
Anna Markowitz, Alexander Mihailovich, and Robert Bendicio, thank you all for being with us. A great pleasure to hear your voices this morning, as always. We'll be back right after this.